Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Robin Green has an incredible resume. She wrote for Rolling Stone magazine in the early 70s. She's an Emmy Award-winning television writer and producer, most famous for her work as executive producer and writer for HBO's The Sopranos. She and her husband, Mitchell Burgess, created the CBS drama Blue Bloods. They also both wrote on Northern Exposure. Green is a graduate of the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop, and she and her husband have been back at the University of Iowa this past semester teaching a course in writing for television. And if all of this sounds like an exemplary career of a talented woman climbing the ladder of success, it is, but the journey she has taken to get there is pretty wild. She has written about the high highs, the low lows, detours, and decisions in her new memoir. It's called The Only Girl: My Life and Times on the Masthead of Rolling Stone. And Robin Green is here with me now. Hello, Robin.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here. And your book tells the story of a pretty incredible and strange journey through life. So let's go back to the late 60s, the early 70s. Let's go back just a little bit earlier to talk about college a little bit. That's where you found your voice as a writer. But did you find direction? Did you think this is what I want to do with my life?
I would have, but I didn't really feel it was available. I entered the Mademoiselle magazine short story competition because I was a big short story writer on the campus of Pembroke, which was in It's Brown University, but then it was called Pembroke College for girls. And I sent my short story in, and I didn't win the contest, so I gave up the idea of being a writer right then and there. I just had to be practical, you know what I mean? So it really never occurred to me that I could do that. You know, that maybe I could work where that was being done, that I could work in a publishing house or that maybe a magazine like Mademoiselle, although I was bitter about Mademoiselle after that, of course. But it never occurred to me. No, it was not something that people did then. People. I mean, men did it. And there was one girl from Providence who escaped from our golden ghetto of the East Side Jewish community of Providence, where the nicest houses were. One girl, Jane Kramer, became a very famous journalist, but I didn't really know much about her. She was a myth more than a mentor or anything like
right.
that.
Right. So not a plan you felt you could follow?
No, not me. I mean, my parents didn't go to college. My grandparents were immigrants who lived upstairs and spoke languages, you know, different from each other and screamed at each other in Yiddish. And it just, you know, it was great to get into a Ivy League school, you know, as a townie. And I boarded there and I had that experience. But really, you were trained or girls were trained in the 50s and 60s when I grew up to be secretaries, you know, as we were called then.
Mm-hmm. But you didn't want to take that route.
I did take that route. I took typing. Are you kidding me? I was a really good typer, sort of. Not steno. I didn't go that far. But that's stenography for, you know, you millennials.
Right, a lost art. Where you pick up right before you ended up writing for Rolling Stone, I mean, you describe a point in your time in your life where you were a little bit lost. You were living in Berkeley. You had a boyfriend whose main goal every day was to get high, which he did every day.
Yes.
And you were working as a waitress.
Yes.
So at that point in your life, tell me how you made the connection with Rolling Stone. How did that leap even happen?
You know, I have to laugh because I was lost and then I was found and then I was lost and then I was found. You know, it was like a zigzag journey, I called it. My editor thought that was pretty accurate.
Yeah.
But, you know, I had worked for Marvel Comics. I was Stan Lee's secretary in New York City. So I had that job and I had straight jobs, as we called them.
And you could have stayed at Marvel.
I suppose, you know.
But again, that wasn't the direction you wanted to go.
To Chicago. And I really, I thought when I was in college, I think I wanted to be one of those New York women with nice suit and a briefcase and high heels, you know, going to a publishing house or a magazine. But when I got there, I was more comfortable at Marvel. I went, you know, I wasn't sent to any publishing houses by the employment agency. I was sent to two advertisers. I would have been a Mad Men person, and Stan Lee at Marvel. And I felt comfortable at Marvel, and that was that. You know, that's the job that I took up, and it wasn't going to be advertising. So I had had straight jobs, but when I got to Berkeley, well, I didn't have to work because David had money. And that was a new experience for me, not to have to work. That was really, really cool until it was really not. Do you know what I mean? It was really boring, and I didn't feel good about myself, I think. And so I got a job. And, you know, David, because he had money, because his father, you know, strung him along on just enough to live, he just marveled that I could just go out and get a job because I didn't care really what kind of job I got. The point was to make a living and have my own money. And so
you
I
were waitressing.
But it was a very, you know, high end kind of corporate faux English, you know, roast beef house down in the Berkeley Marina. And I wore a little, you know, maid's outfit, a wench outfit and stuff with very short, you know. It was those were the days, you know, that sort of thing was rampant.
All right. So from waitress to Rolling Stone, and Rolling Stone was a relatively new magazine. It was the hippest, the coolest.
Yeah, it was the hippest, the coolest. And it's why I remember where I was standing when I read my first issue. And that was on my lunch break at Marvel standing. I remember the corner I was standing on waiting to go back to work after lunch and just thinking, wow, you know, this looks like fun. And then I became a real reader of it, but not the music necessarily, and not the reviews. I really like to listen to music, but I liked reading what the writers thought. Mm-hmm. I wanted to know what they thought. It was very important to me to know what John Lennon thought. And I think Eric Clapton was on that first cover. So I was sort of aiming for the Bay Area, maybe a little bit, when I left my job to go with my rich boyfriend from Providence to Chicago to live out his faux graduate school year. And faux because he got the money from his father to pay off a lawyer because he had been busted for grass. I mean, that's the kind of, I kept taking these detours in telling this story because how could I not tell about all that stuff? You know, it wasn't me, it was the Times as much to blame. And, you know, I just happened to be in that pocket where you could sort of do whatever you felt like. My brother was a few years older and he immediately became a doctor and married his, you know, college sweetheart and settled down and had children and was a straight guy. You know, he still is a straight guy. But I got to do the other thing. You know, I got to just be headstrong and my poor parents, you know, but they didn't support me exactly emotionally, but they understood that I was going to do what I wanted to do, even if they didn't approve.
They didn't stand in your way.
No, they did not. Well, how could they? Because they had no money. There was nothing they could hold over me. And it wasn't a very strict house. You know, they weren't, when they tried to discipline me, my father couldn't keep a straight face. You know, he just couldn't. They weren't that kind of people. It was a very fun house in many ways to grow up in.
So how did you get an interview with Rolling Stone?
Well, that's where, you know, college connections come in. I mean, you have to be able to deliver when somebody does that. But a girl that had been my friend in the single women, you know, the single girls dorm. In other words, there were single rooms for the weird girls. She was having a wedding and she called me to ask me to be her bridesmaid. And so she said, what are you doing with your life? You know, my boss just went out to California to be the editor of Straight Arrow Books, which was the book publishing arm of Rolling Stone. So she said, why don't you, you know, go and get a job there? You know, why don't you go talk to him? So I guess my idea was to, you know, do it what were the jobs there, which was to be a good chick in the office, you know, and it would be cool, and I'd be right there at the magazine. And I just knew I wanted to be there. I didn't care what I did. And I imagined, you know, I told Alan, I walked in for my interview with Alan. I brought my dog with me because I just thought after wearing my secretary disguise all those years in New York, you know, the pantyhose and the Capizio shoes and all of this, the pencil skirts, that I would go in my own clothes, which was, you know, of course, a mini skirt, the denim mini skirt, and this risque jacket that had a patch on the back that was sort of scandalous, and bringing the dog. And, you know, and I can't use the word on radio, but I just thought, screw it, you know, I'm going to just see what happens, because they were so cool,
right?
You know, they'd understand. So I walked in, and Alan Rinsler, who was this Harvard man, you know, really whip thin and curly afro, you know, gray. Well, then it wasn't gray afro. He welcomed me into his brick-lined office in this cool kind of, Rolling Stone had its offices in a made-over, like, coffee factory or something, and this industrial, it was cool. I was home. And his dog was there, too.
You had a meeting of dogs.
Yes, oh,
we're going to have to take a short break, and we'll find out what happened at that interview, at that first meeting, in just a moment. My guest is Robin Green. She is the author of The Only Girl, My Life and Times on the Masthead of Rolling Stone. And we'll find out more in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. My guest this hour is Robin Green. She is the author of The Only Girl, My Life and Times on the Masthead of Rolling Stone. And she wrote for Rolling Stone magazine in the early 1970s. She's also an award-winning television writer and producer, most famous for her work as executive producer and writer for HBO's The Sopranos. She's also a University of Iowa Writers Workshop graduate. And she and her husband, also a very well-known television writer, Mitchell Burgess, they've been back at the University of Iowa this past semester teaching a screenwriting course for television. But we're talking about the book today and really your remarkable journey. And Robin, just before the break, you were talking about putting on your denim miniskirt, taking your dog, and going for an interview at Rolling Stone magazine. A pretty strange approach, but you get there. And
I'm home.
Exactly. So you weren't necessarily applying for a job. You were making a connection.
Oh, no, I was applying for a job.
All right.
Because what I said to Alan was, I will do anything to work here. I'm a really good, I can type, I'm very organized, and I can file, and I'll get sandwiches. I'll do anything you need. I just want to be here.
Right, so you would have done anything at all, but he asked you to write.
Well, he said, your friend who worked for me in New York said that you were a really good writer. Why don't you think about writing? Why don't you talk to Jan about writing something for the magazine? And I was like, what? It didn't compute. I was stunned, really. But that's what happened. He arranged for me to have a meeting with Jan, and I went home.
Who was the...
Oh, Jan Wenner. I'm sorry. Jan was a college dropout, I think, at Berkeley. And he, in 1968, founded Rolling Stone. And this little butterball of a man is just it's really, I liked Jan. A lot of people had trouble with Jan, but I'm just not one of those people. I just have nothing terrible to say about Jan. I could say that he's a star What's the word? What can I say on radio?
Probably almost nothing.
Okay. Well, he likes to hang around with stars, and he is very egotistical. But he would cop to that immediately. He would have no problem with my saying that. And in fact, read the book. He said he read the parts about Rolling Stone and about us, me and him. But he didn't object at all to anything I said. He was really sweet about it. But I went in for – first I – actually sent him. I forget how it got there. I must have brought it over, you know, borrowed my boyfriend's car and drove across the bridge from Berkeley, where I lived, to San Francisco. I put everything from my past in a book, in a box, like a Saks Fifth Avenue sweater box, you know, something you would get clothes in with tissue paper and all. And I had my college magazine, my literary magazine at Brown that I edited, where I was also the only girl on the masthead at the Brown Daily Herald that year. And I put in the Marvel comic books, and I put in my short stories, and, you know, I put in some cookies that I'd made. It was very girly. And I sent this to him, and I went in for my interview, same outfit, no dog. And the box was open on his, he had this round oak table that served as his desk. And the box was there, and it was open, and he didn't refer to it at all. I don't know if it was lame or not, you know, but he was very impressed I went to Brown, because that's the sort of thing he liked. He's a social climber. That's what I can say about him. That doesn't contain a bad word, but he was very impressed by Brown, very lockjaw about it all of a sudden, and although people do say that it might have been the coke that made him lockjaw, he asked me what it was like to work at Marvel Comics. And in those days, see how much I'm talking now? I never talked. I just was so shy and so, you know, backward, sort of pathologically shy, cringing, but just shy, just shocked to be out in the world. But he asked me about Marvel, and I told him about Stan Lee, you know, that he, his name was really Stanley Lieberman, and that he wore a wig, or, you know, and I just blabbered for it, because he was waiting for me to say something. So I just said what it was like, that it was, they were kind of nerdy, you know, and I never in a million years thought he was going to say, well, why don't you write an article about it? I was like, what? But I didn't say that. I said, oh, sure, yeah. And he said, are you going back to New York anytime soon? And I was to be the bridesmaid at my friend's wedding. It all comes full circle. And I realized in the car going home to Berkeley that that meant he wasn't paying for my trip. Right. But I didn't know how it went, but I didn't care.
So you were writing this article on spec. I mean, you...
Well, no, I had an assignment.
You did have an assignment.
He said, I'll pay you 5 cents a word.
Okay.
If it gets killed, you'll get half. And I'm like, and I said to him, 5 cents, you know, I can make more wagers. That's just like, how many words do I have to write in order to make a living? But actually, I wrote 10,000 words, which in today's money would work out to something like $3,000. So it wasn't nothing. It was actually $500. And so I had never had $500 in my life, you know, at once, you know. So, you know, I moved out from my boyfriend. I broke up my boyfriend. I had to leave the dog. That was really hard. It was hard to leave David, too, I guess. But he didn't object. That's the thing about David. He just wasn't very aggressive, you know. He didn't demand a job or anything for himself, you know.
So you publish this first article, and it leads to, you know, your name on the masthead, all of these other assignments, all of these articles. But you really worked independently. When you moved out of the apartment that you shared with your boyfriend, you rented a room in a house, and that was really your home base. You wrote your articles there, right?
Yes, I did. For the next 3 years, give or take, but I, you know, oh, I left that house and I moved in with my married editor, and then I broke up with my, you know, it was just me just making one stupid move after another. But
well, it
didn't seem stupid.
It was also,
you know,
part of the culture, especially not just the culture of the time and the area, which it was, but of Rolling Stone.
Yes, it was.
So that you share a lot of dishy, juicy stories in the book.
TMI, somebody said I should have called it.
There is a lot of information. You are correct. But why don't you just give us a little flavor? There was a retreat, and I find it fascinating. It was a retreat held by the magazine, but you weren't invited to actually participate in the retreat. None of the women who worked for the magazine were invited to participate in the retreat.
There weren't any women writers working for the magazine.
Right, but there were a few other women around.
No, no, it was only for editors.
Right, so it was just an editor's retreat. Okay.
And so I said to Jan, just when I was writing the book and talked to him about it, you know, how come I wasn't invited to the editorial retreat down in Big Sur? You know, it was in Big Sur. It wasn't much of a retreat. You know, it was just like a lot of drugs and drinking and staying up all night. But and he said, well, it's because you weren't on retainer. And I said, oh, yeah, well, I guess I wasn't. And then later it occurred to me, well, why wasn't I on a retainer? I never even asked or thought about it. I don't think I wanted to be that beholden, frankly. I just wasn't serious about being a journalist at all. And I had no ambition along that line. And I wasn't suited for it. I was so shy. And so it was painful for me. It was really hard to go to Dennis Hopper's house in the desert with all those drugged out people that I didn't know and from Hollywood, and they were really mean and making jokes I didn't quite get, but I knew that I would become a brunt of them if I stayed there long enough. Yeah. You know?
But it's funny because the reputation you had as a writer for Rolling Stone is really brutally honest, sardonic, and, you know, you had an incredibly, and you are obviously an incredibly strong woman, but you had this incredibly strong persona balanced with your shyness. It's so interesting.
Yeah, I guess when I was alone in my room, you know, I could get back, fight back, or tell the truth. I mean, all I ever did, I didn't really make anything up, and I didn't, you know, I didn't engage in the kind of gonzo hyperbole that Hunter did. It wasn't in me to do, you know. It would have been nice to be Hunter, but as it turned out, not so nice. Right. But, you know, I just tried to tell exactly what I saw and exactly what I had done with Jan in that room. I tried to tell what it was like and bring the person there, bring the reader there with me to the room, and remain kind of anonymous in a certain way so that it was my voice or my point of view that came through.
And obviously the honesty shown through in your work, not always a pretty truth as well. But I want to get a taste of this culture. So that retreat in Big Sur, you did go down the next day with the Wives and Girlfriends Day.
And yes.
And tell us about this experience.
Well, one girl who worked in the office, Laurel Gonzalez, had a sort of executive position. She had been sort of worked on the Steve Miller Band in some capacity, and Jan brought her. She had not a tough cookie, smiling all the time, but she stayed at that magazine a really long time, and really, she didn't even know what she thought people called and said they wanted to advertise, you know? So she had to, like, learn everything. She did a really good job of it. So she was invited down. And really, the only time I saw everybody, most of the time, a lot of the time, it was just that one night I was with my editor boyfriend and with Hunter Thompson driving and Annie Leibovitz next to as passenger. Hunter with the, you know, his bottle of wild turkey between his legs as he drove, and a big bag of blue pills of mescaline on the console. You know, is that a console? That thing between where the gear shift is, and you know, we were just
and he was just popping them like
we
candy.
All were. Yeah. You know, because why else would you be in a car at midnight going up Route 1? I don't know if you know about Route 1 in California, but it's like the most beautiful but dangerous road in the world,
and he was driving with the lights off.
Well, but that was because his theory was that you could see the lights of the other cars coming. It was a good, you know.
Sure.
But the only problem, we were all too high to think, well, what if the other car has its lights off, or what if a animal runs across the road, or anything, or any little thing, and there, you know, not necessarily guardrails on that very, you know, that very dangerous windy road.
So you're all careening wildly out of control on the highway.
Not out of control. Okay. It was in perfect control. It took the corners really wide. You know, it's a lot of S turns on that thing. He'd swing wide. That kind of bothered me because we were hugging the road. So when he swung wide, the cliff would be right to our left.
Oh, I'm feeling sick just thinking about it. But and then you all wound up at Hot Springs.
We went back to, we drove up the road. I forget. They were reliving their spirit. Experience they'd had the night before where cops stopped them and they thought that was hilarious and Annie took pictures and for some reason they weren't arrested, but they were reliving that trip and we turned around and we came back. Oh, I guess we were killing time because at like 12 o'clock at night, at midnight, Esalen opened its Cliff Hot Springs to the public. And the conference was really across the road at a motel. But we all went down, Annie and David and I went down into the cliff, into the sulfur-smelling hot springs, and everybody was there from the magazine, everybody naked. And so we took off our clothes and got into the hot tubs. And it was worth everything because it was so extraordinarily beautiful. I was so high on mescaline. Which meant that, not all mescaline or psychedelic trips are happy, but this one was just really happy. And it was wonderful to be there with everyone and smiling and high with everyone and in the hot tubs with everyone. And there was nothing really sexy about it. We were just naked. There was nothing overtly sexy, let's say, but there was nothing going on. But there was a lot of nudity in those days. But I remember getting out of the tub and standing, you know, the cliffs opened up into the air. They were caves, really, and where the hot springs were. And there were whales migrating. And in mescaline, it slows everything down so that I could really see the whales come out of the water really slowly and then preposterously big and beautiful and black in the moonlight and then go head first, you know, fluking down in. And it was just magnificent. So I never really stopped to think about why I hadn't been invited to the conference because really it would have been me and 20 men in a motel room, conference room, you know, a motel room, I suppose, but a big motel room from the pictures. And I'm sorry I'm not in the pictures. I am sorry about that. Annie was there. Annie Leibovitz was there to take pictures, but she, you know, she was always somewhere there, you know, taking pictures.
So if anybody has spent time, and a lot of people have, thinking about those early years of Rolling Stone magazine, it was everything we imagined that it was.
And more. Because we had the music. We had the music, and it was such great music. It still is. I mean, I listen to stuff now, but I still listen to the old music. I get off on the old music. I like to dance. We dance, my husband and I, to the old music and the new music.
Well, we're going to take another short break. We'll be back in just a moment. My guest is Robin Green. She is the author of The Only Girl, My Life and Times on the Masthead of Rolling Stone. And we've been talking about her years at Rolling Stone magazine. Coming up in a few minutes, we'll fast forward in time and talk about her television writing career as well. She was an executive producer and writer for HBO's The Sopranos and many other shows also. We'll continue in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest is Robin Green. She wrote for Rolling Stone magazine in the early 70s. She's an award-winning television writer and producer, most famous for her work as executive producer and writer for HBO's The Sopranos. And she just published her memoir. It's called The Only Girl, My Life and Times on the Masthead of Rolling Stone. And Robin, we were talking about those crazy years. I mean, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, that's what it was all about.
Yes, it wasn't just me. It was everybody.
It was everybody. That you make that very clear. It's a fascinating and very revealing read. I want to talk about the title of your book, The Only Girl. And you write about this in the book as well, that there were other women in the office of Rolling Stone who played different roles. You were the only woman on the masthead. But the fact that you've chosen to say The Only Girl, it tells us a lot about the times, about 1970. You all referred to yourselves as girls, but it also informs quite a bit about how you were treated and how the men that you worked with thought about you.
Actually, we were called chicks. And we were fine with that. It was sort of aspirational to be a cool chick, you know, to be the stunning girl by the side of the shaggy-haired man.
And you all needed to be beautiful.
It was a hiring requirement, I was told, at Rolling Stone. But I claim the word girl. I know when Bill Mayer used the N-word, it's not Ice T, it's some other rapper came on his show and said, we can use that word, an African-American man, but you can't. That's why you got in so much trouble. And I feel that way about girl. I'm just going to call myself a girl, and you can just, you know, live with it. So it's that attitude that brings me to that. I'm fine with it. But I know it has connotations of being a giggly stoop, which I also was, you know. So I still am. I'm giggling right now, aren't I? So, yeah, I guess it was the times. Like, you know, Rolling Stone was a very macho atmosphere, no matter what I say about it, that, you know, that I didn't feel put upon there. There was never a Me Too moment, which is really strange. But it was also because the pill had just come out. There were no AIDS, and all the girls, all the women, all the chicks were doing exactly what they wanted,
and
sexually.
And so were the men.
Yeah. But you could, you know, if you didn't want to do something, you didn't do it, and nobody ever messed with me. I heard a story about Gloria Steinem that some man tried to kiss her and she just bit him on the cheek until he bled. And she said, I didn't mean to. It was just a reaction. Do you know what I mean? So maybe, you know, that, yeah, Gloria, good for you, girl, you know.
So this lifestyle that you all were participating in, and you mentioned Hunter S. Thompson, and of course, and that didn't end well for him. It was.
And for many people.
Right. Yeah. And for many people.
And of my generation with all that.
The access to sex, the ease of which you had sex and others were having sex at the time, and that is what ended up leading to your leaving Rolling Stone.
My demise. My journalistic no-no. I had my big chance at the big time. I mean, Esquire had called and asked me to write, but I didn't really want to write for them. But Jan assigned me a story that probably would have put me on the map, in a larger map in journalism anyway. And not a Hunter, maybe a Hunter-sized map, but it was to interview the children of Robert F. Kennedy, the slain presidential candidate. Oh, it just brings back all the losses my generation suffered, you know, just one after the other.
There were so many.
And then, you know, of course, rock and roll people. But I interviewed Joe. Well, I didn't interview them. I sort of, like, I don't know, talked to them.
Hung out.
Not my, yeah. Well, Robert Kennedy Jr. I definitely hung out with. And so I sort of tracked him down at Harvard, and I suppose I ended up spending the night on his waterbed, you know. But I think that there was
you tell us a lot about that in the book.
I won't tell you everything, but
find out more.
I will say it had a waterbed. That's all. Okay. But I couldn't write the story after that. I just was embarrassed by what I'd done because I felt that it was a journalistic no-no. I just knew that that I didn't want to go public with it. And now I have,
yeah.
Because I can see I needed to make my peace with that. I needed to admit it to the world and say that I screwed up. But it was my ticket out, and I think I wanted a ticket out. You know,
And it may have even been, this is me putting thoughts in your brain, but in some ways, reading it, it may have been a life-saving ticket out at that point. I mean,
maybe so.
Life was hard.
Well, I wasn't really committed to journalism at all. I didn't see a career for myself there that I wanted. I didn't know what I wanted, and I was, you know, I was lonely too. I was all by myself, and life had gone on for my boyfriend and for my other boyfriend. And so, you know, before we get to my talking about television, we have to go come here to Iowa, because what I did was I met a girl who, the one that led me, she had lent me that risque jacket that I wore for my interview, but her husband had gone to the Iowa Writers Workshop, and it just sounded so cushy. And I just thought, yeah, I'll do that. You know, I'll go to Iowa, wherever that is, and I'll write and read, you know, and I'll get, you know, money, you know, I'll make some sort of a living. And I got a job that I could do long distance, which was rewriting porn novels. And
which got you kicked out of an apartment in Iowa.
Well, I did. You know, it was right across these railroad tracks. where that apartment building was now, there was a big, awful-looking Victorian spooky house. It's gone now, but I came to Iowa to start my life over again and to become a virgin again, you know, and I did. I did all of that, and I met my husband and the man who was to be my husband.
Who and is from Iowa originally.
He's born in Iowa in City.
Grew up in Cedar Rapids,
The family moved when he was, I think, 8, 9 to Cedar Rapids, but he's tickled to be back here. He really is. Everyone we meet, he says, you know, I'm from Iowa City. I was born in Iowa City. He can't get enough of it. And he comes back for the games, the football team. You know, he's really into sports. Yeah. And so the football team is just so marvelous. You know, we've been to all the home games, and now I'm a convert. So we've been here teaching, you know, the scene of the crime where we met each other. And we went out to L.A. together, again, knowing no one, with no money. In a $200 car. And, you know, we just had jobs there and worked for a while. But it was someone who had been in my class at Iowa, here in the workshop, who had just created a TV show and remembered my short stories. Because I submitted my short stories to get in there. And they were good short stories or passable. And he thought it would be appropriate for TV. So I got a chance to write for the TV show, and I did. I wrote the script, and it was terrible.
And it obviously led to...
Well, he said, I know you can do this. And then he told me what tone he wanted, which was to read Updike. And I did the Updike short stories, and I used that. I understood what he meant by subtext and all that. So I gave him back a script. I worked like crazy that weekend, like you do when you're desperate, you know, because I wanted to do it. I had a job then as an editor of a magazine working for Harold Hayes, who was a very storied editor who had been at Esquire during its glory years in the 60s. And he was my boss, and then he was fired, actually. But I stayed at the magazine. I was miserable, and I got this chance, so I wanted to make good on it. And I did. I made good on writing that second draft, and that was it for 30 years. I worked in television, and I loved it. I loved it. I loved it. I loved it.
And you and your husband became a writing team.
We did. When I went to that same person, John Falsey and Josh Brand, created Northern Exposure. Three years after I started, and I wrote for that myself for a while, and then I was having trouble with it, and I asked Mitch if he'd help me, and it was just perfect. It was just great. He was so good at it, and so we became writing partners as well as partners. And the rest is checkered history. But
well, and a history that includes HBO's The Sopranos. And
yeah, that was our crowning
moment,
because it was just a labor of love. We didn't know what was going to happen. We quit a really lucrative job to join David, who was starting it up. You know, he had done the pilot.
David Chase.
And David Chase, who I had worked with before, years before in television, my second year. This was later. This was probably 15 years later, maybe less, 10 years later or something. But we just loved David's script. And so we moved, you know, do you want to move to New York? I don't know. Let me think about it. Yes. You know, it was like that. And so we were in L.A. and New York, for a few years. But then we sold our L.A. house. We live in New York now. But the Sopranos experience was just heaven. because everyone loved the show. Everyone loved the show, and everyone loved their part in it. And for a long time, it was just heaven.
And it was so groundbreaking.
Well, it was groundbreaking, and that, you know, my friends could actually see it, and I was proud of it and all of that. But let's not forget the important thing, which was getting the, you know, all dressed up for the Emmys and the Golden Globes and stuff, and having like people lend you diamond jewelry. Do you think I'm materialistic? I don't know. So that was really fun. The whole thing was fun, flying around in private jets, you know, that rock and roll existence back again,
right,
you know,
right.
In a way. I mean, you know, it's nerdy to work all the time, but television is really hard, and people, the writers especially, tend to be kind of nerdy, but it was really fun. It was really fun.
You share so many stories in the book, and we don't have time to dig into them, but I do want to ask you, in going back and revisiting all of these memories, and you talked to a lot of the people that you worked with over the years, you shared some really difficult experiences, the high highs, the low lows, all of it. What do you think you learned from putting the book together?
Oh, that's such a hard question. I thought I was done. I thought I had put everything to rest. I thought I had reckoned with everything and seen it clearly and told the truth. And that was a relief. But really, in the aftermath of writing a book, I've discovered you learn that you're not done, that you didn't take all the lessons you could have taken from it. And I guess that's the starting kit for another book. I don't know. Maybe fiction this time, though, right? Then I'll really tell the truth.
Right, here. Right. I'm sure you have fodder for many, many more pages. But Robin, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It was really fun talking to you.
Robin Green, the book is The Only Girl, My Life and Times on the Masthead of Rolling Stone. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.